Hello and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast with the most wonderful and marvellous fans ever to drop out of the skies. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm a hovercraft full of eels.
And we are back with Patrick Troughton's second season as the Doctor, and today we are covering two very, very special stories. Gentlemen, why are they so special?
Well, was it, you said that it was something like 18 months ago. We didn't have full stories. We had 2 out of 12 episodes we're going to discuss today. We had Enemy of the World Part 3, and we had The Web of Fear Part 1. And then in an amazing, amazing turn of events, what are we saying, nine more
episodes turned up.
That's right.
Curiously and conveniently of consecutive stories, and two of the most wanted and most loved, anticipated. Anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, we
to come up, which may suggest that maybe we'll be hearing something at a possible maybe future.
Do you think we'll have to sit through the other episodes of the Celestial Toymaker one day? We will re-record a podcast for that. It'll be 5 hours long, and you'll all have to listen to it.
I think we might need the explicit tag for that one.
We didn't have this for a long time, but we did have Ridge Lie.
And, of course, one of these special stories is The Enemy of the World.
Hooray! So we had episode 3, which is a strange and sort of uncharacteristic episode. So it did give, I think, a rather wrong impression of what the story was.
You know,
like,
why they kept it, don't you? You know why it was the only one in the archives?
Well,
Pamela Nash did her There Shall Be Fire thing. It's the first episode of Doctor Who to go from 405 to 625 line, which was on the mark. As you know, this is a much denser... We have this on film, don't we? So the copy that we've discovered is on film, so we get it cleaner.
Yeah.
Looking forward to the Blu-ray commentary coming up.
Well, it's not all film, they've vidfired some of it, so it is video time.
But yeah, the 625 line is a huge, huge jump going along with selling to overseas networks, just keeping the format up to date.
Like, weirdly, they do it in the middle of a story.
Yeah, it's just when it came online. That's why this one was kept, because it was as a technical piece, it's a line marker.
So it's a little bit like going from standard definition to high definition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And changed a lot of how the production team would approach the show. I know we've got a lot to say about the rediscovered episodes and what this show's about, so I do hope that we come back to the Victorian Security Kitchen and what an amazing comedy series that would have made if Griffin the Chef had his own spin-off show.
He's spectacular. Basically, this is the only story this season, maybe apart from Fury from the Deep, where it's not the Doctor being menaced by people in stupid costumes.
In a sense.
Stupid monster costumes. Do you know, everyone says that this is a Bond pastiche.
Do they really? Why would they say that?
As well, but... And it sort of is. Certainly the first episode is massively like that. So you've got the Doctor, Jamie, and some... woman.
Victoria's wonderful.
Sorry, that terrible woman. arrive in Australia, of all places, at Cape Arid, which is on the Great Australian Bight in Western Australia.
Is it? Oh, okay.
And it's the year 2018, which we didn't actually know until the episodes were returned.
Yeah, because there was nothing in the script about that, and it just appears in a cutaway of the Doctor going, oh, when was this helicopter registered? Right, it's...
No, there's actually a little text disc behind Mirror's head.
And there's something else as well. There's a newspaper or something from last year. We can't spoil it, but it's later on when they see an old newspaper and it says 2017. So it's...
Certain things go a bit bonkers,
crazy. So it's set 50 years in the future, in 2018. In Australia, it's a very, very, very grim day when they arrive in Australia. Miserable.
When I lived in Western Australia, the weather was just like that.
Really?
Glowy.
This is very southern English
It's after 2 in the afternoon.
Maybe that's why there are so many English expats in Perth.
No, they are anyway. Because all South Africans and expat English folk. It's very, very similitudinous to me.
But we're absolutely in the middle of nowhere. The Doctor decides to throw all of his clothes off except for his hilarious sort of long johns, comedy long johns, and he goes jumping about in the sea. It's really, it's spectacularly funny and massive. Like,
everyone's doing a comedy turn as someone else, aren't they? You've got, even the TARDIS is doing its comedy turn and swapping its doors for this episode.
Oh, really?
Everyone's got to be at that nerd moment about the TARDIS. Yeah, the doors swap around.
And of course, Victoria's dressed as Jamie.
Victoria's doing a drag actor's pantomime peer drag actor's Jamie, and doing it better, actually. The whole thing. Yeah, we know we're in for a romp right from the first moment, don't we?
The other big first is, of course, that this is Barry Letts for the first time. And Barry Letts...
Helicopters!
He's going to be huge. That's exactly right. It's going to be huge. He's going to be huge in the early 70s. But he was an actor and a director before he became a producer. And so this is him directing. And as Richard says, helicopters and hovercrafts.
That's we how get you know it's Barry Letts.
A giant chase. It's like Planet of the Spiders episode thing.
Episode
only,
15, I believe.
Only entertaining. And, and that is the big Bond moment. It's a little bit like Bond being chased by the helicopter at the end of From Russia with Love. Is that right?
Yes.
I'm brushing up for when we abandon
this. No, you're right, because, so far we're still up to Underwater Menace as far as Bond references go in Doctor Who, because the last Bond to be released was, we were just on You Only Live Twice. Thunderball had been out for a couple of years. That came out in 65. You Only Live Twice is 67 release.
And this,
one is broadcast right at the beginning. So, yeah.
So we have had You Only.
They've seen volcanoes hollowed out and men in Nehru suits with comedy Middle European accents and bald pates. And we've had that. We've had it all.
I love that film so much. That's Roald Dahl.
It is. Mm. Roald Dahl writing a same... You're talking about repeated plot. You Only Live Twice is the same script 3 minutes after itself. Mm. 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. It's like an endless ad for Japanese cigarettes, Japanese cars and Japanese whiskey.
Yes.
I'm just going to go on the record and say I think it's one of the worst Bond films.
For that reason, really? I love it because it's Thunderbirds with racist accents. But this Doctor Who story improves on every Bond film we've seen. I think this is probably the most intelligent script we've seen in Doctor Who in the history of the show so far.
And so, of course, it's Whittaker.
And it will stay up being clever until very recently in the show's history. For me, this is, it may not be my all-time favourite, but it's soundingly smart.
One of the great things about it, and we have mentioned before, I think.
What is it? What does it do? If you haven't seen this show, what is it?
So,
because it's not Doctor Who, is it?
Well, no. I mean, it's a political thriller. And Doctor Who will do political thrillers, most notably in a couple of years' time. I think Ambassadors of Death has the same kind of feel to it.
That's a Pertwee story.
Yeah. So,
and from a story by David Whittaker again.
Yeah.
He's clearly a politically minded man.
So, and it's a sort of slightly crummy political thriller in the sense that it is sort of Bondian. But the big conceit is, of course, that the big Bond villain, Salamander, is played by Troughton. And so Troughton does a comedy accent. Not really a comedy accent, actually.
This is just one of the misconceptions about this story. Because it was missing, everyone thought that Troughton's performance as Salamander would have to be comic and pantomimish, when actually he's quite a scary villain.
he's very
charismatic. You know,
Bond villain.
Just like a Bond villain. You hate him, but actually you quite like him as well.
He allows the comedy to be the second and third bananas around him. There's a lot of expat Time Lords in this one, aren't there, as the people supporting him. We've got Milton Jones.
Yes, as the evil Bennett.
We've got George Proctor as the lovely Dennis. Yes.
Dennis.
And we've got, can I just mention, the greatest girl who should have been the companion, Kik Sylph Farrar.
Yes, well, this is a bizarre one too, because we have actually got two women in it, and that happens very rarely. So you have Astrid Ferrier, who is Mary Peach, who is sort of auditioning to be sort of on a Blackman.
Well, she was actually up for the Diana Rigg replacement part on the Avengers.
She was going to be Tara King.
The name hadn't been formed yet, but I believe, Brendan, she was one of only five actors in the final run.
She was very, very close to getting
it. Nairi Dawn Porter, Mary Peach. Anyway, yeah,
she's got the sort of hair.
She's tied to Bench Girl, isn't it? Bench Girl, isn't she? Zip up and let it go.
In the wonderful book, Who and Me, by the late Barry Letts, where he talks about Enemy of the World, he does say that the characterisation of Astrid, as played by Mary Peach, was a, quote, direct pinch
from Honor Blackman and Diana Rigg, right. Unquote.
And does it beautifully, and it really accurately and suitably, because that's what this show is about. For so much this year, this story is about what's going on in the world of media right now.
So the Doctor is sort of initially, is sort of a bit suspicious of her, and you know, like her goons have been after him, sort of firing at them. And firing at her, bizarrely. They're her men, but they do fire.
It is more like a Spike Lee script in this first episode, yeah. Isn't that?
But he really, he likes it. He flirts with her outrageously, actually.
The Doctor does, doesn't he? Yeah. This is the first time we've seen something of the actor stabbing himself into the role.
But what's also amazing about that is several minutes later, when he's being asked to impersonate Salamander, he turns to Jamie and says, "Don't you think he's rather good looking?"
Yeah.
You know, it's the Doctor actually being flirty in that modern way that modern doctors are flirty with their male companions
We know how flirtatious Time Lords are actually able to be with all their internal pink wobbly bits as well, don't
we? Well, yes. As we're recording this, dear listener, Death in Heaven has actually gone out today, and Nathan and I have seen it, but Richard hasn't.
No, plugs in all parts. Yeah, yes, please don't ring in with any details.
Yeah, he knows who Missy is, but he doesn't know what happens next.
No. I think she turns into Julie Andrews and flies away with a talking umbrella.
Ooh, it's unwavering. So that's the one woman is Astrid Ferrier, and then bizarrely someone with almost an identical name, Ferrier, who is
the beautiful Carmen Munro.
She's wonderful.
She's my she's my favourite girl in Doctor Who so far.
She's
love her. So straight, so real. So are we saying meta now instead of trope? So there. Isn't she? Really? She doesn't come from Doctor Who at all. She comes from the big screen.
She's Salamander's food taster, she has some history with him. She hates him, but she works with him. Presumably he's got something on her, because we see Salamander in later episodes, you know, doing blackmail and all of that sort of thing. But she really dislikes him, and she's just strong and fabulous. It's a great performance, and she's a black woman, and you know, that's a real rarity. 60s Doctor Who is
strong, intelligent, educated black
woman. Yeah.
She's the first black character played by a black actor who actually has a character.
She's not a mute strong man.
She's not a mute strong man. And even Jamaica, who I've cited earlier as being a positive step in terms of the representation of non-white races, even he didn't have much character. He was more of a function. Now, Faria, this is 50 years in the future, so no one ever mentions her race inside the story. No. It's never treated as an issue. But in a way, that makes it even more important for the 1960s audience.
We had the Chicago riots in the US just a year before. Fires, deaths, the whole thing, the police getting turned upon. This was a major thing. Britain was dealing with the influx of immigrants from the former colonies. Star Trek hadn't hit British TV screens, as we mentioned before. Gerry Anderson hadn't cast UFO live action for another 2 years, where you have black British actors in major, important and beautifully played roles. Dolores Mantez, who'd been up for this part as well, another Jamaican brilliant British actress. Please keep going. I love this story. not for the obvious reasons that we might actually say, because it's a Bond film, it's clever and it's witty and it's a ridiculous script. The actors all nail in a superb performance. No one's really lazy in this one.
No. There are great people. So the cliffhanger to episode one has the sort of world head chief security guy, who is Ruben from Horror Fang Rock, and his name's Bruce.
Come out, old one!
And he's
Colin Douglas, and isn't he good? I hadn't realised it was Ruben.
He's really good.
And he's got a lovely gruffness and true British, you know, military thing, but always, you get the sensibility and the truth behind the character as well.
It's like Cresson talked about last episode in The Abominable Snowman, who gets an arc where initially you think he's sort of rigid and inflexible and security-minded and paranoid and that kind of thing. And then you discover he has a real sort of sense of honour and loyalty and things. And Bruce, like, it's slightly crummily done, but Bruce is eventually persuaded that it's worth investigating whether Salamander's a bad guy.
Yeah.
But the cliffhanger,
logically and cleanly, yeah.
And people always say this about the cliffhangers in this story, where it's very rarely, you know, if someone's tied to a volcano or, you know, you have to answer an Ice Warrior's question or we'll suck all the air out of the airlock. You know, they're very rarely stupid. Their characters discover something or the game changes slightly. So the very first one of these is Bruce comes in and Giles Kent kind of forces. Giles Kent, who is sort of a Bond character, he's like the previous head of security.
He wants to get
the Doctor to recruit the Doctor into sort of finding Salamander. He sends the Doctor off, makes him dress as Salamander, and then the Doctor comes in pretending to be Salamander, doing a crapper version of the accent, you know, than when Trouton's playing Salamander.
In a turtleneck. That's
right. And the cliffhanger is, will Bruce be fooled, you know, by this?
And there are lots of cliffhangers like that. There's that cliffhanger where Salamander begins to suspect that there is an impersonator.
And that's with Bruce as well. That's, you know, Salamander and Bruce are discussing, you know, someone who looks like you. You know, that's terrifically good too. You know, the cliffhanger where Mary Peach discovers Swan from the underground base, more of which in a minute.
They're conceptual cliffhangers. Yeah. Rather than, as you say, someone tied to the railroad tracks.
Yeah. So why are these characters so interesting? What's happening in the story that's making all of these people come together? Because it's kind of a complex plot.
Unlike
a Bond film.
They blow all their money on the first episode, so everything else is kind of like indoors. Yeah. You know, you don't get any big action sequences. So it's not quite like Bond in that sense. It's a crazy thing
to have done, isn't it?
But they've done it before. Certainly, you know, Dalek Invasion of Earth blows a whole heap of money in its first episode, and then, you know, episode two is just in various studios. So there's a precedent. But, you know, basically it's a political thriller. Salamander is trying to gain control of the world. He comes to the world as a kind of savior. He's developed some way of making food. Like making food crops and that sort of thing. But we discover that he's using treachery and blackmail and all sorts of things to kind of get his flunkies into sort of positions of power. And so, like, Jamie and Victoria go to Hungary while the Doctor stays in Australia. The Doctor's in Australia the entire story. And they go to Hungary to investigate him, and he's blackmailing the Central European Zone guy or something like that.
Yeah, Federin.
Trying to get him to replace Denesh, who is George Pravda.
Yes.
And so it's all this sort of fun intrigue and things. You know, people are betraying people. He's a Bond villain because he's really causing earthquakes and stuff like that in order to get what he wants. That's sort of basically the thing. And the thriller thing is fun, and it works, and it's a Doctor Who will sort of turn to, you know, in later years.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mention that it sort of blew its money in the first episode, because Barry Letts really wanted that. The original script was far more complex. He says in his autobiography that it called for a crowded beach scene, and he actually picked up a pen and crossed out the word crowded and wrote the word deserted instead. Now, the thing is, though, the Doctor was going to be hunted through the amusement arcades and what have you. So that was gone, so he had to figure out something else. So he got the helicopter.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, the helicopter will be more expensive, but we'll get more bang for our buck. And apparently the BBC said to him, well, that's okay, but you've got to figure out where the money's coming from somewhere else. So reworking the script, because apparently the scripts were a bit thin on the ground, reworking the script, they came up with episode 3, which for the longest time was the episode that existed. And I'll quote here, "The stuff in the kitchen, for instance, goes on far too long. It's full of padding, and padding shows up at its dullest in a half-hour show. And isn't it ridiculous that the VIB prisoner, Denesh, played by George Pravda, is held in a corridor rather than in a room? The whole episode, number 3, is lacking in tension. Nobody is in any real danger except poor Denesh, and we don't know him well enough to care very much."
It's fine when you see it in isolation, but it actually works as a great relief in the story. And it's really belittling to a man of his prominence to put him in a corridor. It's actually quite serious when you see it.
But what none of us has mentioned is Griffin the Chef.
Who
is from Woolloomooloo, and perhaps he should never have left Woolloomooloo, he says. And he's really funny.
It's good.
It's not true that it's padding. It is kind of character stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a variant of light relief after all the other stuff that's going on, which just increases the tension.
Whitaker's famous for kind of delaying, you know, where the Daleks are coming, you know, sometime soon, you know, all of that sort of thing. We're used to him doing this delaying tactics. And here, you know, I presume that what we all want is the face-off between the Doctor and Salamander, do you know what I mean? And that's what we're waiting for. And the Doctor's actually weirdly not doing anything.
It's a contrivance so they don't have to do split-screen. is what I feel about it. Because the Doctor sits there for about four episodes going, no, I refuse to get involved unless you give me some actual proof that this man is horrible. It's like, when? When do you ever wait for proof? Like, you know, 2 months ago, it's like, I suspect that the Cybermen might still be alive here. I'm going to open up these tombs so five people die. This man is causing famines and killing people. Well, until I see a body, no, I'm not doing anything. But it's so strange.
Fortunately, though, while the Doctor's sitting in that lovely caravan, admiring the crockery, you do get Pratt playing Salamander, and he's compelling, and you actually kind of forget that he's the Doctor. It really
That's
is extraordinary.
Very true. I was impressed by the strength of his performance as Salamander. I kind of wish, in a way, that they'd done a little bit of a massacre with it and actually just had Salamander and had the Doctor missing. You know, Salamander could have even kidnapped the Doctor. And that way you don't have to constantly be coming back to the Doctor, resetting every 25 minutes to say, no, I must have more proof. Yes, okay, you've shown me the bloodstained knife, but I must have more proof. Yeah. I think that would have been far more interesting and far more dramatic if Salamander had discovered the Doctor earlier and kind of went, you know, you could cause damage to me, so I'm going to kidnap you so you can't pretend to be me.
Yeah, except you do want to delay that confrontation, you know, and when the confrontation comes, it is massive and epic, and we'll talk more about it. But should we move on to the really, truly weird twist?
Oh, God,
so
yes.
Salamander is... Patrick Troughton is playing the Doctor, and he's also playing Salamander, but Salamander is playing another character as well, where he is a survivor of a nuclear war.
Yes.
And he has a group of, like, terribly wet English people dressed in Leader Clegg's cast-offs.
In lemon yellow jumpsuits. Truly.
Yeah,
truly.
Yeah.
He's Rick from The Walking Dead.
Yes. I don't know anything about what that even means.
You young person.
I'm scared of zombies. He goes down this incredible lift shaft, and they have great miniatures to the lift, you know, that works really well. And he finds himself in this base, and it turns out that they all know him as Salamander, who goes up and scavenges food for them, and that the whole place is sort of full of radiation, and they can't go out. There's been a giant nuclear war.
Take a drink, David Whittaker.
and so they're busy creating the earthquakes and volcanoes to destroy the evil kind of mutant survivors of the human race. And it's just completely strange and unexpected. The English people, and remember, we've been in Australia and Hungary, we haven't been to England, and these people are presumably underground in Australia, you know. We haven't been to England at all, so these are sort of very strange English people, and you've got Colin and Mary, do you know what I mean? With, like, these incredibly kind of... Colin is amazing. Colin does a lot of staring wistfully into the middle distance acting, talking about how lovely it would be to see the surface.
It's like Logan's Run 20 years earlier.
It's really terrible.
Without the talent of Michael York.
and then, you know, Salamander's found out by one of the people, Swan, who discovers in one of the food packages he's brought down that there's a newspaper with the story of a liner that sunk.
Yes.
A holiday liner. And Salamander explains to him, not everyone's dead, they're just all evil, scary mutants who have holiday liners.
And Swan just kind of goes, oh,
okay,
right,
fair
okay,
enough.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
So
we've just seen this in the Avengers episode, The Living Dead, haven't we, Brendan?
Yes, yeah. that's very true.
But without the mutants.
Yeah, without the mutant scary zombies, these people actually want to be underground.
And with Julian Glover.
Are led by
really?
Future Doctor, well, past Doctor Who star and future Doctor Who villain, Julian Glover. Yeah.
Wonderful.
It's a good one, yeah. Mm.
So it's strange. It's like a complete turnabout, and it has him going into a completely different kind of story.
Mm.
So, and then, you know, everyone sort of defeats him and things, but it really has been like a very, very strange fun run around that goes to places and has a story structure completely different from anything else in this season. And it's just a massive relief from furry, scaly or metallic people attacking people on a base this month again.
I don't know. There could have been a Sontaran.
Yes, if only there'd been a Sontaran. A Pteroleptor, perhaps.
Oh, it's much more than that because it's Whittaker. We've got all these other layers. You know, Salamander is a villain, not just The Bond thing's obvious, but he's an imperial senator trying to take over the empire, isn't he? To me, he's the threat to Rome and the Senate of a new empire. He's Augustus, isn't he?
Rising again. He's depicted as in the United Nations, isn't he? And there's even a shot, and am I dreaming this? There's a shot of the United Nations building, but it's like the zones, like the government zones and stuff, and he's going to take over.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. It is that he's like, he's Senator Palpatine. That's really my background. He's Senator Palpatine, and they're going to become the emperor and take over from the benign democratic government of the world zones.
Mm. Yeah, except for the fact he's actually got some decent dialogue, unlike Senator Palpatine.
He's the only good thing about that entire prequel trilogy.
Oh, he's brilliant, but his script is awful.
Yeah, it is.
But he's loving it, though.
Yeah.
And this guy, of course, because it's Whittaker and he's so interested in the history of British magic and medieval folklore, a salamander was a creature that lived and was born of fire and could destroy and burn with its gaze.
So, hence the volcanoes.
There's always layers with a Whittaker script.
Yeah.
I am Salamander Stormborn, father of dragons.
That's the one.
Is that another pop culture reference I get?
I was actually thinking, with Salamander's plans and with the underground culture, it almost feels like the production team have looked at the Underwater Menace and given David Whittaker the same ingredients. We have this underground culture being led by a mad despot who actually wants to destroy the world. But unlike Zaroff, who just wants to destroy the world for the scientific achievement, Salamander wants to rebuild it along his own lines. And so, he has already gone into the business of food production, which is something Zaroff was concerned with as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's like he's taken a similar plan to Zaroff, not that he would know about it, but he's taken a similar plan to Zaroff, but thought it through to its logical conclusion. It's much easier to save a bunch of people and then say, I am your leader, and they'll go, yeah, okay, you're our leader, than try and conquer a bunch of people and say, I am your leader.
It's very clever, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very clever.
It's very clever.
And, you know, it's not explicitly spelled out that way, but when you think about it, it's very clever.
Was this Innes Lloyd's Christmas present and his swan song story to Paddy, because Patrick had been saying for so long, I'm really getting ground down by this and the shooting schedule, the fact that even the audience is starting to get bored by the repetition of the plots.
Mm.
So they've given him, you know, it was talked about, was it not, at the beginning, that this Doctor would be based on Chaplin when they looked at other archetypes. This is the Great Dictator, isn't it? We've got Adenoid Hinkler playing up against the Wily Tramp.
Yeah.
Adenoid Hinkler being his character that throws the you know, and Mel Brooks spoofs it beautifully, throws around the globe of the world. And this is up there with those big cinema ideas. And honestly, it is, because, and I know we all sound a bit loving when we say it, but we can cut it out if you like, but Pat is really, really good in this. He really is that level.
He's amazingly good in it. And this was one in particular when Rob and I were making our way through and watching. It's one that neither of us really enjoyed. You know, I think we both gave it about 4 or 5 out of 10. This is before it was recovered.
Oh, okay. You were watching it on
watching the recons.
Yeah.
And again, the recons are very good. There's some CG in this recon for the whole going down in the tube sequence.
Sure.
Really, really well done.
But you weren't getting the fibre or the subtlety of the performance. See, that's why I don't like recons.
Yeah. But when we watched the real thing after it had been returned, we kind of discussed it. And yeah, for both of us, our estimation went up to like 7 or 8 out of 10. It is by no means perfect. It probably needs a bit of script tightening.
Mm.
But that's quite common with David Whittaker. He's got such big ideas that how do you cram those into 25 minutes of television?
Mm.
But it's such a worthy story. And I know in these podcasts I've been defending the fact that the plots are repeated in this season, but that's okay because they come with new ideas each time. This is very, very refreshing and very interesting and very different.
It was, yeah.
I'm not sure if I'd say it's my favourite of the season, but it's definitely very high up there for me.
Look, I mean, I haven't really properly seen Fury from the Deep, so there's every chance that that will take over as my favourite Doctor Who story when I watch it early this week.
Foreshadowing, dear listener, I don't think it will.
Okay. But certainly, this is my favourite of the season, and it might be my favourite Troughton, and it is really spectacularly fun. I mean, it really is. It's something special. Funny, great characters, you know, interesting plot, demented, over the top, something Doctor Who has never done before. And Doctor Who has stopped at this point being a show that does things that it's never done before. And that's a great shame.
And when you look at where we can only go from this, imagine how good The Dominators is going to be.
Oh, God. The Dominators is the only fully excellent Doctor Who story that I've never been bothered to finish.
I don't know how you can say that. It's in the future. And,
It
must be good.
I'm sure it'd be better if it had a fish person.
You know, I have been wondering if our listeners out there would like us to do a commentary or something. And I think a commentary on The Dominators with us steadily drinking more sparkling wine could be very interesting.
And then me leaving the room midway through the episode.
There's a reason we get so little feedback on the podcast.
Because you make threats like that. Just before we go on, I will say, you know, when you have seen so much Doctor Who, even when you're watching stories that you haven't seen before, there's often very little that surprises you because you can kind of extrapolate and know what's coming next. But there is something that really shocked me the first time watching this story, and that is the sudden, tragic, and quite meaningless death of Faria.
She's such a startling character.
It's so brutal.
And well, it doesn't belong in Doctor Who, does it? It's lifted from film. Yeah.
But, you know, it just makes you already dislike Bennett. He's already a sadistic little bully.
He's so great.
But he's also, until that point, he's been quite comedic. Like, when he discovers Faria has betrayed Salamander, he sort of looks off into the middle of the distance and says, "Faria." And I expected him to go on with, "I just met her." And then, like, 5 minutes later, he guns her down. He shoots her in the back. And when we were watching the recon, I actually paused it. And I just, "Do you think she's..." I said to Rod, "Do you think she's dead?" And he says, "Oh, no, no, she'll be all right." And then, you know, the next bit of the recon is Bennett kicking her over. It's like,
He threatens to shoot her again. She's already dead, and he's sort of threatening to shoot her.
They do.
And she says something about, you know, only being able to die once, I think. And it's really horrible.
And he whispers over her to get the answer, and that's what she says, "You can't frighten me anymore." It's really surprising to see a Doctor Who story.
People blame Eric Saywood for that kind of thing. But
Eric will do sort of 20 of those in an episode. No, I don't think it, you know, like it is, you know, I've spoken negatively about violence and nastiness and stuff in Doctor Who, particularly in season 3. But I don't mind it here because it's appropriate to the genre that he's doing.
It's appropriate to the genre, and because we care about this person, it's actually meaningful.
Yeah.
And because she's such a great performer.
I think the Doctor's quite as upset when he learns that too.
Well, he should be. She's the only one. We talk about, you know, this not being part of the Who realm, but she's also one of the few performers that isn't a little bit pantomimey, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way. Doctor Who's always been a little bit children's fiction. It's been okay to see. You can see why there was so much rub with Bill Hartnell and the production team over how he saw the show going to how they wanted to take it. This is each year. I guess that's why it's interesting. Even though it's being so formulaic, it's still pushing against itself. These moments with this character Fire and with Milton Johns and all the rest of it doesn't really belong in Doctor Who. But that makes it all the more interesting to watch. And for a modern audience, it's probably the freshest of the season. I think it's hard to get through all those episodes because, it is padded. And we keep forgetting, you're not really meant to watch it as a movie. It was never made as a movie.
No, this is one of the most Saturday morning serial.
You're meant to have time in between each half hour,
Although there is a problem this season, which is that it's 4 episodes and then every subsequent one is 6.
The
6-parters are pretty terrible.
They're pretty much all 4-parters, which have been expanded out.
Because we lost those werewolves of Canfield, didn't we? the Dougie where Canfield's Operation Werewolf.
Oh, yeah, thank God.
Well, I don't know. This is rumoured to be the one that was basically put together.
No, okay, right.
No.
All right, speaking of Dougie Canfield.
Dougie Canfield is directing our next story, the classic, or is it, Web of Fear?
Could bring that back to our last outing. I know the production team will.
Yeah, say goodbye to Space Adventures the last time we hear it. That was it. Maybe we should play it again. Let's just have a whole podcast with just that sound.
Just before we do discuss the story, our second baked good of the season, Rod has made us Yeti Pat brownies.
Except we've already eaten them.
Yeti Pats. Yes. I didn't think they had a digestive tract.
Well, you see, that's why they were square, because they're robots.
Fair enough.
So the
feeling of being unwell now.
It had the squishy icing as well, didn't it? Yeah. They taste a lot better than that.
So they were chocolate brownies with cheesecake.
They were. So. Is that why they were so easy? I think that's been the best so far.
Oh, there you go. There we go.
So pretty good.
There's a recommendation, and the recipe will be up on the website at the time of this episode. Richard, I believe you're covering Web of Fear.
Well, I'm diving in there. Look, there's a lot to say about it, but there's also not much to say because we're back to formula, but we're also finally getting to see how formula can be done beautifully. You've got the double award of having Douglas Canfield, so whatever you give him will just work because he's so smart and logical and yet creative within that. And it's his favourite realm. You've got army boys and shooty things.
Because he was in the army.
He was. Yes, and he's most happy when he's got a whole lot of blokes in green serge with pointy things and something running at them from the other end.
Phrasing.
Yes, yeah. That's the one. Mm. But look, this is the reboot story. We've got Dougie Canfield. We've got Derek Sherman on now as script editor. This is it. Goodbye, Ennis Lloyd. He's left now.
Yeah.
We've got Terence Dix as assistant script editor.
It's his first. It's our first Terence.
Terence. And we've got Peter Bryant, who's in the role for as long as anybody ever would be in this era. Yeah. But you've got some really good people working on this. This is maybe the best Target novel of the year. I think Ian Marder's Enemy of the World would have been the best Target novel, but W.H. Smith, when they got it back in the day, which was the early 80s, it's certainly a long... It went way over count, so normally we recommend reading the book. Don't read the Enemy of the World paperback. It makes no sense because of the injudicious cuts that they did. And Ian Marder's such a good writer. But this one, this one's worth doing because it's Terence, and it's Terence's first script editing job, and you get a really nice little Target novel out of it. What's happened is... Interestingly, and we referred to in Abominable Snowman that the great intelligence, Richard E. Grant, thank you. I want to say Rupert Everett because they're kind of played as camply as each other, aren't they? But Richard E. Grant in covered in cobwebs floating around in space. The TARDIS is hauled out of the vortex, or is it? So that is it actually in the vortex when it finds itself being covered in. It is.
Well,
spray on cobweb.
Yeah, when we see it from outside, it just seems to be in space. But
But it's the place of the inhabitants of the great intelligence.
Yeah,
so it's the astral plane.
It's the astral plane again.
Woo woo. We're up there. So have a meditate and see if you can find the TARDIS. It'll be up there somewhere.
Oh, man, they've had me home.
That's the one. This is great for all the little moments. The beautiful sets, the London. London Transport were ringing up BBC furiously demanding their £200 an hour fee because they thought that they'd filmed in the underground. Sets are so good. You don't agree?
Well, no, they're spectacular, but everyone is walking on wooden floors and stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. So it's fairly clear just from the quality of the sound. Perhaps the London Transport people hadn't watched television before.
They're probably watching on old TVs. I've got to say, I actually didn't pick that up. I thought this was film quality from 67.
Yeah, it looks good.
It works like really well.
Yeah.
And all of that's great. Oh, the sets, but it's the lighting and the scores. Well, let's start at the very beginning. You see Travis in a much-aged makeup with mugging away in lots of close-ups and with this extraordinary chiaroscuro lighting under Bartok's music for his piece Percussion and Celeste and Strings. Stanley Kubrick used. It's the same Deutsche Grammophon for The Shining in 1980. Right. So that beautiful piece of Bela Bartok.
And we're on film, I think.
We're on film, and can I just say, it's probably for the last time of the series, we have pure German expressionism. The way that's filmed, the close-ups, the way it's staged. It's funny they talk about the 30s having been back, because this looks like a 1920s way of shooting. And then before we move on, Canfield really gets where he's going with this and is setting it all up. It's an amazing opening sequence.
It is a bit of a pity about Silverstein, though.
Oh, he's so straight out of the ghetto.
It's
and out of
very
the,
lazy stereotyping.
It's completely so.
And so, Travis, just to make it clear, Travis is your Alan Quatermain adventurer from... Abominable Snowman.
Except
and
now
he's got aging makeup because it's 40 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, and now you see, the fascinating thing with that is, as when I was younger, I watched the first episode of Web of Fear more than I watched episode 2 of Abominable Snowman. So in my mind, that's what Jack Watling looked like. When I got around to watching the full reconstruction of the Abominable Snowman, there's a lot more of him visually in photos, and I, as I mentioned last week, actually found him quite handsome. I had a great new appreciation for the makeup job and the acting job he does in this.
You think so? I actually think he's really theatre in this, and he kind of stands out as not being, not necessarily worse or better, but it's just not being on the same level and acting in the same way that everybody else in the studio is. He's very stagey. It works when you've got a lot of blokes dressed up as monks, because they're all kind of doing the same thing. But here you've got a lot more of the, you know, the realism thing, the army boys. I think it kind of stands out as not fitting in.
It's a great idea, though, isn't it? Like the doctor, they come back. They come back 40 years later, you know, and there he is, and he's got a daughter.
So how... Well, it's the first time he's come back and met someone again,
still,
aside from the monk. Who
that's
was
true. He might have a bit of Alzheimer's, because he certainly doesn't recognise Jamie. Maybe that's how he's playing.
I think it works. I remember thinking this at the time, but it is just that, you know, it's been 40 years since he's seen Jamie, so he sees a young person. There's no way he's going to think it's Jamie, because Jamie's really now 60-something.
Yeah,
you know?
I believe he does comment, you know, those two young people look familiar, but I don't know who they are. Because, yeah, his brain can't...
And he's never seen the TARDIS, he says. You know what I mean? Like, he'd heard about it.
Sure. Although, weirdly, yeah.
And it is... It's the episode where Pat's having a little lie down as well, because he's been exploded.
But you've also got some of the best support... You talk about the young people. You've got this... Some of the best supporting cast. In fact, you know, got the template for all future stories involving this kind of setup. You've got Anne Travers.
Oh, God, she's great.
Anne Travers is an archetype not just for the show. Well, I mean, she's Liz Shore.
She is proto-Liz Shore.
You look at episode 5 when they're pulling apart the sphere and chatting away. It's almost like, I mean, it's not like, but it's almost, even the camera angle's the same as episode 3 of Spearhead
from Stonehenge.
With Carolyn and John.
Well, in fact, they're working on a control device that has short range.
Yeah,
that can be used to neutralise sort of strange robotic villain thing.
Well, you know, coming up next year, there is one major character that we're deliberately holding off in a Whittaker style and haven't mentioned who this story is famous for introducing.
Brett Bonham.
Exactly. It wasn't going to be Jean Marsh's brother coming back for Invasion. It was written for Anne Travers. She was going to be the repeating character along with Jack Watley.
Yeah, and it wasn't
available.
We'll get to the...
How amazing is this support character woman? I spent, it feels like 2 years now, bemoaning how Carol Ann Ford's part of the Doctor's granddaughter was so poorly served and poorly, you know, it's poorly addressed. But you've got, in just the space of a couple of episodes, you've got Anne Travers completely sounding off against the David Frost character of the reporter Chorley. They're all in a bunker. They're all stationed down in the underground. World War II was still a big deal 20-plus years later in the public mind. This went out on the 25th anniversary of the Bethnal Green disaster, when over 130 people were killed trying to get out of one of the undergrounds in a bomb raid.
Right.
So it was really poignant for the viewers at home, and they said the claustrophobia of this and is amazing. Yeah, but I know there's a certain character called Lethbridge Stewart who appears in this story, but he really doesn't have much to do. It's actually the Anne Travers saga, isn't it?
So Anne gets two great things. The one you mentioned where she completely owns Chorley and calls him a gutter journalist and talks about his comic strips, reducing everything to a comic strip.
You know that's all about David Frost.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And he's terrific. And he wanders off sort of and then sort of comes back towards the end. But then the other one is that
with Knight.
Yes, when Knight...
Should we say that Nick Courtney was actually cast as Captain Knight, and David Langdon what else has he been on? He's been in Avengers, and he's a lovely sort of... He's the kind of Hugh-what's-his-facey-poos from... Hugh Bonneville is a character. He played a similar part in soaps at the time back then.
Right.
So David Langdon was actually cast as Colonel Lethbridge, as he was, and the Stewart was added later. I think the Lethbridge-Stewart, the Scott thing, was added simply to make sense of why Jamie is so sucky to English soldiers.
Because he's part of the Scots Guards.
Yeah, and he's wearing a Stuart tartan on his hat, and that's why Jamie seems to accord him so much with the civility and so much. It makes no sense to me that Jamie is so sweet with the English soldiers in this. He should be.
Yes, why isn't he? Yeah, that's right. Getting his dirk and stabbing them all.
As you should.
For killing the Laird.
And just for being a bit rubbish. Anne is amazing. She, as you were saying, she also gets that fantastic line of, why are you a scientist? Why did you
what's a girl like you doing a place like this? Oh, well, when I was a little girl, I thought I'd be a scientist. Then I grew up and became a scientist.
Man, you always got the Batman powers just coming up. How amazing would it have been if we'd had her?
Yeah, she's beautiful, and she's like smart under pressure and stuff. And she doesn't go hysterical or crazy when her father gets kidnapped by the Yeti.
She's in control. Whereas Lethbridge Stewart goes a bit nuts and wet in pants. He runs upstairs and gets that great location, Covent Garden shooting. This is the first and only time. You don't like it? I think it's great. I think Canfield cuts it really well. But the point of it is, it's a massacre. The only one that comes back, and this is the future Brigadier. He goes and hides at the top of a skip. That's the only way he escapes. And he comes back down, loses it, gets a bit wet, mumbles.
Well, I mean, it's that thing where they wipe out half of the cast, you know, in episode 4.
Yeah, but we don't need them anymore.
But can we talk about, because the thing that I think spoils that location thing in episode 4, which is clearly the big set piece.
It's
directed. And do you remember those photos? They appeared on Facebook. They were, like, discovered a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And
it's
like, the Yeti goofing about at Covent Garden.
Yeah. And there's that one where the dog comes up to the Yeti and kind of is scared and stuff. So, anyway, so they're in Covent Garden, there's Yeti, and they're redesigned Yeti. And weirdly, the redesign is completely telegraphed, because in the first episode,
it transmogrifies.
Yeah, and they do a rollback and mix.
The intelligence is able to transmute matter.
Yeah. So that's presumably why it makes all those sort of incredibly crap control rooms in both of its stories. No, it gets monks to do that. I think the new Yeti look even more stupid than the previous Yeti. And they've got, like, they've got nose beaks, they've got mandrel eyes.
I like them. How good do they look in those tunnels? And how good do they sound?
Yeah, they sound good.
Do you know where that sound comes from?
Slow down toilet flushing.
It's a Thomas Crapper system.
It is.
Slow down.
From Tooting Beck.
It is. It's the Lumini Yeti sound. I've never been terrified by them before, but
they, they are scary sounding, but gosh, they look stupid. And at this point, and it's the point that I've made before, at this point they play Space Adventurer.
Just in case you missed the point that they're lampooning themselves.
All of the monsters are interchangeable.
Yeah,
this week the robots have shaggy things. Yeah. You know, like in a few weeks' time, they'll be weed, and then in a couple of weeks' time, they'll be back to wearing sort of plimsolls and shiny silver.
This is the one where they're plugged into your randomizer and just come up with four random ideas. Robot, Yeti, underground, webby stuff.
web shooting.
We've got the BBC phone machine back again.
Hooray!
it's still getting more of small script action than Michael Crane's did.
Yeah, it's kind of cruel, but it's
Oh, yeah, that's it's not an indictment on Michael Crane.
No, Crane's, that's what I mean. It's kind of cruel thing that you're right. Mm. It's exactly what it is.
And you see, this is where it's very strange, because, I mean, once again, yes, it is the same kind of structure for the story, but I think it just proves my point that it's not so much the structure of the story that's important. It is the extra decoration that the script comes with. We have a collection of interesting and well-developed characters. We have, you know,
Charlie. It's nice to see Nathan agreeing.
Imagine, though, if you had different types of stories with different types of well-developed characters.
Well,
do you know what I mean?
Like, you're something. We kind of get that next year.
Yes, but we don't get it this year, and that's really my point.
But I don't think season 6 is as successful as being entertaining as season 5, but we'll get to that next year. But as I was saying, because we have these interesting characters, we have an interesting whodunit element. Because in the first Yeti story, we knew who the conduit was. We knew it was Padmasambhava.
I just love saying that. Padmasambhava. I spent a lot of time practicing. Yeah.
And we knew that
Padmasambhava
was controlling Songston. This time,
with those really cool little Daypaw figures
which Debbie Watling still has one.
Oh, does she?
I was co-hosting a convention last year that Deborah Watling was at, and one of them was up for auction somewhere. I mentioned that to her, and she said, "Oh my God, I've got one of those."
And she was controlling the Yeti all along.
And she asked me to look it up online, and I did. And I showed her how much it was worth. And she said, "Well, I don't want to sell it, but it's nice to know."
How much was it?
About £6,000.
£6,000.
Maybe.
So do maybe control
the Yeti. Let's get Wickling. That's
you just stick it in the Brigadier's pocket.
But yeah, we just don't know who the conduit is. And for those of you, it's a possibility that. For the first time, I think, in this podcast, we can say for those of you who haven't seen it, because you hadn't seen it, Nathan, until you were watching it for this time, there's a possibility, dear listener, that you don't know who the traitor is, so I'm not going to mention it. But when it happened, that's a nice thing. I was surprised by who it was, but at the same time, I thought back over the plot and went, it can be. And I'd also like to say, I really like John Rollison in this. Who plays Harold Chorley. And part of the reason I really like him in this is, dear listener, you may not know this, he was a very short-lived sidekick in The Avengers.
He is too.
Yeah. After the original Avengers lineup with Ian Hendry and Patrick McNee as the co-star.
Dr. Martin.
John Rollison came in to play Dr. Martin King for three leftover scripts.
Or Tara to his mate.
Before they figured out, actually, we can cast a woman and we don't need to change the script. Yeah. And you've heard me say before that Honor Blackman's role was essentially just written for a man and they crossed the name out. Well, before they did that, they thought, let's have another man in here. And it was quite difficult for him on the set because he was a jobbing actor. Yeah, he had to accept work as the corpse of a dead king in Shakespeare who's just dragged out and dropped on stage for the first act. And that's how he was supporting his family. So he took the Avengers job knowing it was only a 3-week gig, knowing he was in this big thing, because the Avengers was still big. Already, but knowing that he wouldn't be a part of it for too long. And I was really disappointed when I saw his Avengers stuff because he's not really good in it, but in this he's great.
Yeah.
And he did have a nice change in luck because it was during this time he had a 6-year stint on Coronation Street, and that is what he's remembered for. Nathan, I know we're butting heads on this again, but I think this story is the whole Base Under Siege thing in Apotheosis. It is as good as Base Under Siege gets.
It is.
And part of that is because great direction, great writing, great characterization.
Great characterization. We've got an epiphany in this. You don't get that very often in Doctor Who. The reason Lethbridge Stewart is brought back is because he has a rite of passage. He loses those troops, and he's a very different character in the fight, although he does suggest to the Doctor that he self-sacrifices. I wish we'd seen a bit more of that in the Pertwee era. But there was that moment of where he'd been a completely different, quite manipulative... Well, he's the Red Herring. We're supposed to believe that he's... It's difficult for us to watch it now.
Everyone.
He's not the villain. But you're meant to assume that he is at the time.
Everyone's the Red Herring, though. For a while you think it's Evans, for a while you think it's Chorley, for a while you think it's
Travis.
Even Anne's under suspicion.
I don't think that stuff's all that strong. But I probably agree with you that of the Base Under Siege stories this year, that this is the best one. But it did wear out its welcome. I think it's 6 episodes. And I think the Yeti are stupid, and that's a problem.
It's like we said before, it would have made a great 4-parter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I quite like the end. You know, the Doctor has a plan and Jamie has a plan and they try and execute them both and Jamie's plan ruins the Doctor's plan. You know,
the Doctor's plan, he said, was to drain the Great Intelligence. But does that mean that he was going to absorb it and actually become omnipotent?
Doctor? Hello, parting of the ways.
When you absorb a gin and tonic, you don't become a gin and tonic.
Oh, bits of me do.
It depends how many gin and tonics you absorb.
I don't know. It's just a curious thing. It's not really explained. Isn't it possible that the Doctor could have actually taken on more powers? And that's why he was so aggrieved. Because leaving a villain floating up in space... Well, we've mentioned before that this second Doctor is a lot darker than we might have casually viewed him previously. He's certainly been manipulative this season. I think maybe there might have been something going on there. Perhaps there was a plan to go back to Gallifrey one day. I shall go back. I don't know how that would, but why not?
It was at this point in America, the original X-Men comic series was still running, but it was very shortly to be taken off. And a feature of that original X-Men comic series was that Professor Xavier and Magnus Magneto could actually communicate on the astral plane.
It's getting crowded up there, isn't it?
And they would often have discussions on the astral plane. And, you know, early Xavier is not a very nice man. He actually attacks Magnus on the astral plane at various points and tries to sort of burn out his brain and that kind of thing. And, you know, I have to wonder if the writers were, at the very least, aware of this comic tradition that was now coming out of the United States, because Marvel was getting bigger and bigger in the States.
But the Marvel stuff was actually picking up on the hippie stuff that we've been talking about before with Leary, so that's not necessarily the primary source, although it's a big part of this whole story. Yeah, everyone was looking at astral plane with terms that George Harrison was using it in conversations and interviews. These were terms that were very new, but it was certainly piquing interest. I think the Doctor was actually up to something a lot darker than any of us realised. Darker, necessarily? Well, depends on what he would have done with it. You wouldn't expect someone to like him to actually be after power, but then again, things do tend to work out for him surprisingly. Maybe he isn't falling into everything in the way that we're about to discover at the end of next year. Perhaps things aren't quite as simple as we have assumed.
Ooh. Evans gets a chocolate bar from a vending machine, and it's Camfield's chocolate bar.
Is it really?
They take
a tanner. They take a sixpence piece. That machine takes a sixpence piece. That's all phased out by 1975.
The whole 1975 thing.
It's
now,
unit dating.
You were saying something earlier. It can't be 1975.
It can't be 1975. The ads are Christmas 1967. We've got product placement in this one.
Yeah, there's a film starring Sidney Poitier and something, which is this.
Yeah, there is. Which is okay. It could be a revival. But there are other things that the actual London Underground. And Jamie, weirdly, now can read these maps even though he's never seen it. Underground train before. There's a few things in here that it's definitely late 60s. It's not meant to be anything else. The 40-year thing, it could be vague. There's a suggestion that the Abominable Snowman could actually be in the 20s, not in the 30s.
Then no one would know what a robot is. Because the word robot's like invented in like 1920 by
Taron Capel. Yeah.
By Taron Capel, in his famous play.
That's the thing. I've always been of the opinion that the whole 1975 thing is easy to work out by the fact that the only person who says it was 40 years ago in 1935 is Travers, who's already been shown to be a bit eccentric and to have a faulty memory.
Well, he thinks he can lose the control sphere behind the sofa, as just his daughter does, something as important as that. No. It's the late 60s.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the only way to explain the costume choice.
That's when this really happened.
No. Yeah, visually.
No, I get it. I also think, too...
Covent Garden is still a costermongers thing. That had stopped by 1970. They're still flogging fruit and veg when they go up on the... Again, that had stopped in 1970. So
I actually think that the unit dating controversy is just ridiculous, really, because what you're arguing about is in what year did Yeti invade the underground and London get evacuated? And your only possible answer to that would be that never actually happened. Or it happened on television in 1968. So the unit stories all happened in the year of transmission, but they only happened on television because they're not real.
The current series addresses that.
No, they make fun of it. Tennant says something about, you know, like he worked for UNIT as a scientific advisor in the 70s, or was it the 80s, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
See, I actually have a theory about it, but I'm not going to express it now because it revolves around something, a certain event that happens in a certain Tom Baker story. So I'm going to wait until we get to that story, and then I'm going to drop it because I've never seen anyone else.
I'm guessing it's Seeds of Doom. I might be wrong.
I'm going for Pyramids of Mars.
We'll wait and see.
Okay, seal it in an envelope.
Well, yes. Brendan is from 1980.
He is from
1983.
Oh, God.
friend of the podcast, James Selwood, is from 1980.
Yes, as he's often mentioned. in those Andy Pandy pyjamas. and that's worked out why he wears those.
So, coming to the end of another podcast. Just a reminder, folks, we do now have a regular giveaway competition with the podcast. Just like us on Facebook and share this episode, comment on the episode on the website to be in the running for a target book of your choice from a selection that we had donated to us by a friend of the podcast, Tony Galuzzo. It does also count if you follow and retweet us on Twitter and then comment on our website too. We'll mention this on the show notes as well, of course. And just before we go, gentlemen, I'd just like to hear a brief opinion. Do you think there's more missing episodes that are coming back that we don't know about yet?
We hear things that are then said no, but yeah, look, there are. There are rumours of, and I don't think I'll get into any trouble because, you know, there's only three of you listening. There are some Queensland fans who have had Marco Polo for a long time.
Oh.
There are other sources, and there are internal frictions, you know, and the payment thing. But yeah, look, they are out there. It's too much. Let's just apply Occam's razor. It's too much of a coincidence that the two stories that, you know, in the general astralness of fanniness that the fans most wanted were Web of Fear and Enemy of the World from this season. They were, you know, after on the convention circuit, these are the ones they talk about. They both turn up. Of course they're out there. We just have to hope they come out before we're on dialysis machines having to watch them in a mirror.
What would you most like to
come out? Obviously The Massacre. It's such a popular choice in this podcast.
No, really? Actually, does that not exist? I felt like it. All 12 episodes of The Massacre exist.
What I would like to see are the ones that are the hardest to come to on an audio and the ones that don't necessarily, like you were saying, Brendan, earlier with Enemy of the World, didn't really grab you so much as a reconstruction, but you and Rod really got it when you watched it. Because you're seeing actors in real time doing stuff with the faces that actors do and voices and all the rest of it. Faria just blows me away on the screen. And I always loved her as a character in the audio. That's my first love. But there's an audio. But that, no. She's just, Carmen Monroe is just it for me this year. She's my go-to choice if we had to give an award to this season. It's Carmen Monroe. What would I like to see? The ones that are the most actually, the ones that are actually about the subjects of performance. So, yeah, it's still a massacre. Mm. Anything with an M, actually. Mythmakers as well.
Yeah, Mythmakers would be something. Power of the Daleks is such an obvious choice. One that I want back. I've got no idea, do you know what I mean? Like, there were all sorts of rumours and things, but everything seems to have dried up. And I think it's all closely associated with the, you know, demise of the classic DVD range. I don't know. Like, that probably didn't have to end. You've got to think that, you know, maybe they had some releases scheduled because they were expecting something and then had to drop them. So rather than doing the thing which you would have expected them to do, which is release special editions of things that had already been released or whatever, the thing has just gone away. So
I think it has more to do with the comedy recasting by Sir Ian McKellen and Derek Jacobi in the hit show Vicious, now starring Philip Morris and Ian Levine on their Twitter feed.
I think we have to cut that.
I don't think you need to, because everybody knows it.
Yeah, no, seriously. It is sadly very public. And
don't cut it, seriously, and keep this in. It's okay to put it out there. Everybody is saying this. It's on Facebook. People are saying this on Facebook. On the Doctor Who page, just say, Philip Morris and Ian Levine are just the great comedy duo of all time. I think you can see the kind of characters that are involved in this and the reason that the certain folks, you know, people might be holding stuff back. It's all out there on Facebook, easy to read.
Yeah, that's why I think there is something else going on, because the way that the people involved are acting, and in this case, Philip Morris and Ian Levine and their animosity with each other,
I'm really wanting that six-part show to be... Rebecca Front could direct it.
And I just think there has to be more than we know in order for there to be this frisson between them. In terms of what I'd like to see back, I would actually... If I could only get one more, it would be the Macra Terror.
Wow. Yeah, good choice.
One, to have more Ben and Polly.
Yeah, that's good.
And two, because, as I said last podcast, I think it is the best story of that season.
Yeah. I quite like to see Xenia Merton's dance, though, in Marco Polo.
Marco Polo would be amazing.
Yeah.
Let's
just
be honest. We want the whole lot.
I want
everything for Christmas.
I even want the Space Pirates back.
I'd love to see the Space Pirates, actually.
To see it. It looks amazing. You could watch it with the sound down.
Right, well, on that note, dear listener, we will be back next week finishing off season 5 of Doctor Who. We are under siege by seaweed and foam and cybermen in Fury from the Deep.
Again.
And The Wheel in Space.
Ah, another David Whittaker story.
Another David Whittaker
Mental.
Story.
Yeah.
Is it as good as Enemy of the World?
Maybe.
Come back next week and find out. Until then, good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Flat to Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Internal Pink Wobbly Bits, was recorded on Sunday, the 9th of November. The next episode will be released on December 7th. You can find us online at flattoentirety.com, Flat to Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. If the leader of our world zone promised good summers for all, we'd have eternal winter.
We've got one more episode for season 5, which we will actually be recording the day this episode comes out, because today is Doctor Who's birthday. The day we release this episode is the 23rd of November.
Which means it's Clara's birthday. I hope she's still around. I haven't seen the end of this
season. No.
We do hope she's...
Oh, I'm not going to say anything.
Oh, are they all living on the astral plane with the great intelligence, Richard E. Grant and Missy?
And Celia Imrie.